Call to order the Housing Policy and Finance, Public Health Finance Division. And we're pleased this morning, Representative Kim Norton is going to talk with us about the fine work that she's done on legislation passed last year dealing with radon and environmental toxins. And I guess we're going to have an update and hear from some national folks and try to see where we are with this whole legislation and your effort. So welcome to the committee, and if you want to start, go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to introduce some folks to you, but first I'll give you a quick update. Just as a reminder, last session we did pass some legislation signed by the governor that has radon-resistant new construction now in the building codes. Actually, it's going to be in the energy code, and hopefully we'll have an update later today about where we stand on that, because while the bill was signed into law in April and took effect in August, it does take some time to get through rulemaking, and I understand we may still be in the process, and so hopefully we can get an update later this morning from the Department of Labor and Industry, who I believe is going to have a representative come into the room, or perhaps the Department of Health can give us an update if they know, because they will be here as well. One of the things I think I'd like to share that was very exciting for me was that Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, has received some national recognition in the last month through the U.S. EPA. And they actually are starting a campaign to double the number of radon-resistant new homes in the country, and I think our legislation will places us at the forefront in making that happen. One of the other exciting pieces of information that I learned, and I have for you in a handout at the table, and hopefully you can take a peek at that, which is what radon-resistant new construction will do to the industry's efforts toward green homes. And one of the things that many new buildings and also homeowners are looking to is to have green homes, either using the LEED, ANSI, or I believe there's a variety of labeling green home labels that folks can apply for. And the radon-resistant new construction is one of the approved methods toward green home labeling. And so you do get a number of points. It's generally a point system, although I think they're all a little bit different. And this moves all Minnesota new homes kind of a big step toward that green designation, which I think will be a real plus for the industry, in addition to making a level playing field across the state for builders, which is also a positive from our legislation. And just before I pass the microphone on to our first speaker, I do want to let you know that I have been working with, and there's a handout I believe on this too, with the Realty Association in getting their support and understanding about the radon-resistant new construction, and also their help in assisting people who might want their home tested for radon either before it sells, the current home, and it's placed on the market, or else information for new buyers who might also want to make certain that their home is radon-resistant. And you'll hear more about why that's important, I think, from the speakers this morning. So that's just a quick update of where we stand. If you have any questions with regard to that, please ask it, or you'll probably have your questions answered in the next little bit by our next speaker.
Okay. Any questions? Ready? I do have one. Because we're talking about new homes here, is the presentation going to include some information about retrofitting old homes? Or I think the legislation, Representative Norton, did it just address new homes?
It did this year, absolutely.
And are we interested in looking back at?
And I think one of our, yes, absolutely. Okay. And I think we'll hear about that issue and perhaps some ideas for current legislation that we may want to consider with existing homes.
Then I do have one other question. You said the rules are still in progress. Have you had an update on where they are?
I have with me the last letter I received from the Department of Labor and Industry, and it does say as part of the letter, and I quote, "We do have a near final draft and we'll be publishing the notice of intent to adopt very soon. It's dated December 11th. So it was my anticipation that it was going to be adopted in the new energy codes, and that I was thinking we were talking either a January or March deadline, but I don't know exactly where it stands. And as I said, hopefully the Department of Labor and Industry will be here later and can address where they are on that and how quickly, because I frankly am getting calls from builders myself asking when does this take effect. So they are waiting, and they're looking forward to that date. So,
and just a final question. You made a distinction between the energy code and the building code. Do you want to see how those interplay on this particular issue?
Well, maybe they can address that as well. Originally, okay. the legislation stated that it would be in the state building codes, and let's see if I can find this. There's a state here, a statement, and I'll just read it so that I have it correct. It says, in the 70s, the single state building code was established by the legislature to apply statewide to simplify the number of varied codes that applied across the state. But then cities under 2,500 and counties that had not previously adopted the code were allowed to vote out the code in 1979. Currently, over 80% of the state's population resides in areas where the code applies, so this code will apply to 80% of Minnesota. But there was concern that it is not statewide. And so, it says, in addition, there is a movement within the industry to make the state building code the standard statewide. And we have heard that there will be legislation proposed this coming session to establish that. So that would take care of the other 20% that currently does not fall under state building codes, and the energy code is under the state building codes, as I understand it. And that's where this will sit.
All right. Thank you. And we'll hope that the department will be here. And they've been invited?
I spoke with someone on the phone yesterday, and they were at that time planning on being here to address any questions that might come up.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. So let me introduce Scott Hendrick from the National Council of State Legislatures, Environmental, Energy, and Transportation Division. Scott.
Thank you very much, Representative Norton, and I'd like to thank the committee and Representative Norton and Representative Clark for inviting me here today.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Scott Hendrick. I'm with the National Conference of State Legislatures in the Denver office. And the National Conference of State Legislatures, as I'm sure most of you or all of you know, is a bipartisan organization that is here to provide information and to assist the legislature in their work. And so I was happy to be asked to come today and give an overview of what states are doing in the area of radon legislation and what they have done with radon statutes in the past. And a good place to start out when you're speaking about what states are doing is always what has the federal government done on this issue. The main area where the federal government has acted is through the Toxic Substances Control Act. And under Title III, which addresses indoor radon abatement, it states that the long-term goal of the United States is that air within buildings in the U.S. should be as free of radon as the ambient air outside of buildings. However, there's no language in this act, which is known as TSCA, which makes work mandatory. And so the result is that state programs on radon are voluntary and not mandatory. There are, however, 35 states that have acted and passed laws addressing radon, so it is a very prevalent issue among the states. Looking at the laws, both what has been passed and what's pending in state legislatures around the country, you can sort of categorize this action into six broad categories, which I've tried to do here. There's no particular order to these categories. These are just ones that I think fit most of the action that we're seeing. And today I'm just going to run through some of these six categories. The first is required residential testing for radon. Currently, there are no states that require residential testing for radon. However, in New Jersey, there are three bills currently that would mandate testing for the testing requirements would be after or before the sale of a residential property, and for residential rental property, it would be at least once every 5 years. And then if the results came with elevated levels of radon, then mitigation would be required. And the elevated levels that are set in the legislation are at 4 picocuries per liter, which is the action level that's been set by the U.S. EPA for radon concentration. The next two categories of radon action are similar and can sort of be grouped together. And the first one of these is disclosure of known radon hazards at the time of sale of residential property. In these requirements, usually these requirements are included in statements of the property's conditions that a seller must provide a potential buyer during a home sale. And these include usually a long list of things, and they vary by state, but they include, for instance, how the water is received into the home, whether it's well or by the sewer or water system, municipal water system, what kind of heating system, what kind of waste disposal system. And then oftentimes, in many states, they require that a seller disclose any environmental hazards, and included in that often is any known radon risks, or if the test has been done on the home, what the test results were. These laws were passed as a way to provide potential buyers with enough information about the home so that they can make a decision, an informed decision about whether they'd like to buy the home or not. Here are a couple examples that I just pulled out. There's nothing particularly special about these laws, but it just gives you an idea of some of the statutory language that you see around the state. In Maine, the statute requires that the seller of a residential real property shall provide the purchaser a property disclosure statement containing the following information. And one of these pieces is hazardous materials, the presence or prior removal of hazardous materials or elements on the residential real property, including but not limited to radon. Oregon has slightly less extensive language, but in the property conditional disclosure statement, it asks, has any portion of the property been tested or treated for radon gas? And then the seller would either circle yes or no. One of the consequences of a disclosure statement, again, it was meant to provide the buyers with information about their homes that they're buying. But a potential consequence of this is that it can provide a disincentive to the sellers or homeowners in general to do radon tests, because they don't want anything negative happening. And so that leads into the third general category of radon action, which is notification of the risk that radon poses generally at the time of sale. And just last year in 2007, Illinois passed the notification law, which is significant because it was probably the most extensive law, notification law, that we've seen across the nation so far. And there are really two main components to the Illinois law, which was Senate Bill 1425. The first one is that there's a specific disclosure or notification list about radon that sellers and buyers and, if applicable, real estate agents have to initial. And this disclosure statement has a number of different line items, but it includes acknowledgments that radon is a carcinogen and causes lung cancer, and that also that the Illinois Emergency Management Agency recommends all home buyers have a radon test performed prior to purchase or occupancy and mitigated if elevated levels are found. So that's sort of the first chunk of this Illinois bill. The second part of this is that buyers of residential properties would have to be provided a pamphlet that is produced by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency about testing guidelines for in real estate transactions. And it, again, gives a brief overview, some basic information on radon. Again, has the recommendation that all homes be tested, and then puts forth guidelines on how to conduct the test and what to do if elevated levels are found. So the notification laws are seen as a way to boost testing of current homes that have already been built. Radon-resistant new construction standards, which this committee is familiar with, is a way to perhaps mitigate radon before a building is even built. Because this committee is familiar with this issue, I think I'm just going to breeze over this for now. The fifth category of radon action that we see involves indoor air quality of schools and child care facilities around the nation. Currently, no state mandates the testing of public schools or public buildings, though all 50 states recommend it, that testing be done. For instance, and the extent to which states recommend action varies, but for instance, Ohio provides free testing for all schools that request. Again, here are a couple examples of current pending legislation in the states. In New Jersey, the Assembly Bill 4134, it requires that all public schools, private schools, and charter schools be tested for radon every 5 years. New Jersey actually passed something similar to this several years ago, and it's in the statute, this language. However, a certain charter committee on local mandates, I think it was, found that there was a constitutional issue with it, and so this bill is hoping to address that. But currently, the statutory language in New Jersey is not in effect in relation to these school and child care facilities. New York, here's another bill. This mandates schools educate students and parents of any known environmental hazards. And this bill, the scope of this bill, is much broader than just radon. It includes other hazards that might be found in science labs. But included, specifically mentioned, is radon. And then if schools would also be required to adopt a plan to minimize the presence of hazardous substances in schools. So again, these are just examples of what we're seeing around the country. Finally, a fairly large area of action among the states in regards to radon is in terms of licensing and certification requirements that states pass. Currently, about 18 states require certification of radon workers to some extent. These are either done via state statute or via regulation. Usually, the bills refer to two agencies, the National Environmental Health Agency, and then the National Radon Safety Board also does certification programs, and oftentimes legislation will relate to those two programs that would require certification. Some states do their own certification, and they're listed here: Florida, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, New Jersey, Ohio, and Pennsylvania do their own certification programs. And then finally, outside of those six general broad areas, there's also just some other legislation that doesn't fit neatly into a category but is worthy of mention. There's some legislation, for instance, in Illinois that would recognize Radon Awareness Month. EPA has designated January as Radon Action Month, and so some states support that by passing legislation and resolutions. And then there's also, we've seen action in New York that would provide a partial tax credit to people who install radon reduction systems. And that tax credit, I think, is capped at $1,250. But that's some of the other state action that we've seen in the area. I have provided the committee, and I don't know if everyone has seen that, but over here on the table over here is a list of current radon legislation from the 2007 session and some bills that have been recently introduced in the new session. So if there are any questions I can address now, I'd do so.
Any questions for committee members? I did have one about rental property.
Okay.
Can you review for me again what the those disclosure?
The disclosure in terms of rental property?
Mm-hmm, to the renter.
You know, I would have to double check on that. I know in terms of rental property, the New Jersey bill that would require testing would require it in rental property every 5 years. Disclosure of, in terms of the disclosure laws, I would have to double check. Perhaps I can look into that and perhaps get back to you before the hearing ends today.
Thank you. I think that would be pretty important. I know a lot of our older homes are occupied by renters. I can tell you I represent a majority of renters.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through a struggle recently just dealing with the arsenic in our community, and we had to pass the city ordinance to get the EPA to be willing to work with us to let, you know, renters know what they were finding on the grounds of the homes that they were testing.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there's some federal regulations that does not allow the EPA directly to do that, but now we're talking about testing that's done locally, so that shouldn't come into play. However, it made me think of this because, you know, especially if there's children and others, you know, in basements, sometimes rental housing apartments are in basements.
Absolutely.
I know that's not the only place the radon is, but it seems like that might be one of the...
Yeah, I will look into that, because I know that there's been some state action in regards to mold, about disclosure of mold to renters, and so I would imagine there might be similar action to state, but I'll look into that for you.
Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for coming from Colorado.
All right. Yeah. Madam Chair, we have a second speaker here, and while Mr. Hendrick is from NCSL and is informational in its support, we have someone else here who may have a little bit more of an advocacy bent as well, perhaps. Bill Angel is chair of the Mitigation Prevention Working Group of the World Health Organization's International Radon Project. He's the director of Midwest University's Radon Consortium and president of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. And I believe he just gave out an award also at the EPA award ceremony recently and has been very involved. And it's been a pleasure to get to know him. And he resides in our state, so we have an expert locally, which is wonderful. Bill?
Welcome to the committee.
Representative Norton, thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, and guests, it's my delight to be here. I'm not going to expect you to read the PowerPoint slides that you have on the monitors up there, but I'm beginning with this slide, and let me just summarize it. This slide is a quote from an individual from Ohio who was diagnosed with lung cancer, and he asked many lung cancer victims asked their doctors, why me? And especially in the non-smokers, why me? And oftentimes the doctors suggest, the oncologists suggest, radon in your home. And they'll ask, have you tested? And so many lung cancer victims who've recently been diagnosed test their homes. They find elevated levels of radon, and they're very angry about that because they have not been encouraged to test, or at least they didn't feel that beforehand. In this case, this individual is a real estate broker in Ohio. And you can see what this personal tragic event did to put this issue in his mind and his dealing with his customers. So that's the reason we're here, is to talk about those that are at risk, and we're all at risk with this pollution. Let me just put it in context before going into further details. And that is, compared with other environmental risks that we may regulate at a risk of 1 in 1 million, 1 out of 5 million, this is a risk at EPA's voluntary threshold, opposed to a risk of better than 2%, 2 out of 100, that you're going to develop lung cancer from radon in your home. And so, this is a big league issue compared to many other issues. And one of my tongue-in-cheek slides later on, I asked the question rhetorically, how does this compare with the issue of mold? And I respect mold. I've investigated mold issues in thousands of homes. The health evidence on the radon side overwhelms by a magnitude or several magnitudes the health evidence on health effects of mold. And once again, we all should be concerned about our exposure to mold. Some of us with asthma or respiratory or cardiac conditions more so, but this issue is far more serious. And the scientific debate about this issue in terms of a health risk is very small in terms of debating that risk. So I want to put that in context. Let me go through a few things. This is basically a summary of the introduction that Representative Norton gave. My home is the University of Minnesota. I'm very proud to have been a member of the faculty at the university since 1971. I think I have the greatest job in the world, and I get paid for it. That's all the better I earn that. But I'm here, and I'm grateful for that. Because it's given me many opportunities to pursue this issue, which, put into the Minnesota context, that's a very important issue of Minnesota. EPA's state surveys that have been done put Minnesota at number 4 in terms of the proportion of homes above EPA's threshold for action. So it's a very relevant issue here. And you'll hear more about dimensions of that from Dale Dorschner, who will follow me. My basic purpose is to give you some sense, better sense and handle on the health risk, very briefly discuss on how radon enters homes and other buildings, just touch very briefly upon remediation and prevention, and then to talk about a little bit in terms of my assessment of where we're at as a nation and as a state. And I'm going to leave the answers for some of the questions I'll raise to Mr. Dorschner. Well, actually, I'll tease you with some. Mm-hmm. First of all, what we're talking about with radon is the radioactive gas. It's naturally occurring, which makes it a difficult public health issue to address, because we're predisposed to think anything natural is good. Well, this is something that is not good. And the more you're exposed to, the greater the risk. It's an ideal pollutant in the gas form to flow from where it's produced, which is commonly the soil indoors, where it will be exposed. And you can't see it, smell it, or taste it, as you can see and smell mold oftentimes. And so it makes a more difficult public health issue from that standpoint. To put things in context, radon is part of the uranium-238 decay chain that is widely scattered through the crust of the Earth. Minnesota has more than its fair share, perhaps, and you probably can blame Canada for that because of glaciers. But nevertheless, we have that issue here. In the soil, we're talking hundreds, thousands, or hundreds of thousands of the unit that we measure radon, picocuries per liter, existing in the soil. The outdoor air has 0.4 picocuries per liter. This is a weird unit, perhaps. Basically, one picocurie per liter equates to two radioactive disintegrations that occur in a minute in a liter of air. So to put that in a school classroom context, in a school classroom, at 4 picocuries per liter, EPA's threshold for action, that's about 500,000 radioactive disintegrations that occur just from radon in the atmosphere of that classroom. So that puts a little bit in context. The average level in all occupied housing in the U.S. is 1.3 picocuries per liter. Single-family homes is slightly higher, about 1.5. Apartments are about 0.7 nationally. Unfortunately, we do not have data on ground-contacted apartments, which if we did, it would reflect the single-family average. I'm very confident of that. In Minnesota, to put this in context, the average level in Minnesota homes is roughly 3 times that of the national average. What are the health effects of radon? First of all, to put it in the context, we have over 500,000 Americans that died last year from cancer. Lung cancer is the leading cause, both in the U.S. and in Minnesota. And about more than a third of those lung cancer deaths are due to lung cancer, or excuse me, are due to, actually it's about a fourth are due to lung cancer. The most important causes, of course, of lung cancer are, number one, tobacco smoking, followed by radon. And radon, just to put this in context, for non-smokers, never smokers, is the leading cause for lung cancer. Among smokers, it turbocharges the risk. It increases the risk of lung cancer by a factor of 7, is our current estimate in this country. In Europe, they're estimating it's by a factor of 15. So whether you smoke or you don't smoke, it's an important issue. And I put in context lung cancer from secondhand smoke, environmental tobacco smoke, which this body has dealt with in many local jurisdictions in Minnesota. Radon kills 7 times more by lung cancer than environmental tobacco smoke. There are other issues with environmental tobacco smoke, but you see where it comes. And the multifamily issue with environmental tobacco smoke, you know how contentious that can be. And this is an easy issue to measure and deal with in all homes, including multifamily apartments. Asbestos trails that very much.
Sandra, I think I got a little mixed up on your data here. If you wouldn't mind just clarifying for me again. Can you say, I thought you said that radon was second after smoking in terms of lung cancer. But I think you also then just said that in terms of lung cancer deaths, it's higher than...
Among non-smokers, it's the leading cause. Among smokers, it increases the risk. It multiplies mm-hmm. the risk.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Okay.
And let me just encourage you, please stop me with questions at any time. It's the most important reason I'm here is to answer questions that you might have. And so the last part of this slide says among both men and women, lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer death. I'll put it in context. We look at national data, and I'll get a little bit of a Minnesota perspective in just a moment. And Dale, please, if you have data that's a little bit different, make sure you mention that. From the American Cancer Society, that's where these figures come from. And I apologize, I noticed this morning that I didn't have the men figured quite right. So, but it's pretty evenly divided in terms of cancer between men and women. Lung cancer cases are about 15% of those among both men and women. Men, prostate cancer leads, women, it's breast cancer that leads. And when we look at the cause of death, and then this is where things begin to look more grim, it's because the survival rate, once you've been diagnosed with lung cancer, is roughly 15% after a five-year period. So your chances, once you're diagnosed, of living 5 years is about 1 out of 6. And that's part of the reason this is such a serious issue, lung cancer and the causes of that. Now, Minnesota, some of the data that I pulled, this is American Cancer Society, and again, Minnesota Department of Health may have a different perspective, and I'll defer to them, but my quick look is we have around 25,000 cases that we had last year of cancer in the state. Lung cancer cases are about 1/7 of that, but it's the leading cause again, leading type of cancer that's diagnosed in the state. My estimate is that we have in Minnesota about 400 to 500 cases that are diagnosed of lung cancer due to radon in the home each year. If we look at death figures, and I'm going to drop down to the lung cancer, you see last year we had around 2,500 cases of lung cancer deaths. My estimate is that 300 to 400 of those are due to radon in the home. And I compare that just as a point of reference to motor vehicle accidents in the state last year was just exceeded 500. Tragic deaths, and all of these are tragic deaths. So it's comparable to the number of motor vehicle accidents that occur in the state. And it's roughly 6 or 7 or 8 times greater than the number of fire fatalities in the state, 3/4 of which are in the house, in the home.
I had a question. This committee has looked at our cancer registry and how we track or don't track residential information on people. So when you're saying that these are due to radon, is that a diagnosis that's definitive based on going back and looking at the home? And then a question I'd have is, you know, at what point, since we don't track residential information for a person that has cancer, do we in any way, how are you coming up with these numbers? And are you basing it on just those homes that have been tested because the healthcare provider said maybe it's due to radon and someone then went and tested? Or
your question, Madam Chairman, is an excellent question. And the short answer and direct answer is, you cannot die in a case of lung cancer. You can't point to a cause such as radon. It's by association. Our evidence for radon comes from, in residential environments, comes from case control studies that are done in the field of epidemiology, where we look at, again, across a case group and a control group populations that are as identical as possible in their characteristics. We look at radon, and we look at the incidence of lung cancer in both groups, and we compare those. And the National Academy of Science, and you'll see that in just a moment, has reviewed this data. We have mining data. That's where historically our evidence has come from because it's human cases. And currently our threshold is based on that data, but increasingly as residential. The World Health Organization's International Radon Project, of which I'm part of, is pooling about 30 case control studies from around the world right now and looking at these factors. So that's our primary evidence in terms of our understanding of risk. It's associational and based on case control studies.
So just to review then, someone would have to have a hunch that there's a reason to go and put this person into a case control study. Otherwise, it may never be identified as a positive.
No, that's not the TEAS. The TEAS group is generally drawn from cancer registries. So that's the way the TEAS population gets. And then the control group is selected based upon demographic characteristics that are as similar to the TEAS group as possible. So you might have smoking at X percent on the TEAS. You try to get your control group the same. A lot of times we look at women and keep gender a constant variable between the TEAS and control group. And in each case, then, we go back and measure the radon in the homes and previous homes where the victims and where the control population have lived.
Okay, and then how far back do you go for a person who's been diagnosed with cancer?
We go back to all homes if that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those homes are lost or demolished.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a limitation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. An interesting piece of research came out last year, and I just want to mention it to you. And that is, when we have looked among never smokers in the population, or in this particular study, what has been found is it appears that women have a higher incidence of lung cancer than men. And I think this trend has been observed in some other populations as well. And the reasons for that remain to be defined right now. Some of those that have been identified include radon. But just a point of information. So let me summarize lung cancer figures that we've looked at. It's the leading cause of cancer deaths in the U.S. and Minnesota, and nationally causes about one-third of the deaths. It kills more than breast, prostate, colon, liver, kidney, and melanoma cancer combined. So it's a very serious cancer. Also, 60% of those that are diagnosed are either never or they're former smokers. And radon, once again, multiplies the risk for former and current smokers. This slide is in here to simply say, if you're concerned about radiation and your exposure, and I think you rightly should be, you need to be concerned about radon. Nationally, over half of our exposure, at least as we've looked at in the past, has come from this five-letter R word. In Minnesota, that proportion is going to be much higher. And, of course, there are other things here that we regulate because they have benefits. And the Minnesota Department of Health is the custodian and leader in much of that regulation. But radon is responsible for the majority of your exposure to radiation. Our scientific evidence, and this is what I was mentioning earlier, is reviewed independently by the National Academy of Science. And the last major review of radon that was done was released in 1999. EPA's current risk estimate is based upon this. And this group of independent scientists look at biological evidence, look at animal evidence, look at human evidence from the occupational study and from the residential study. But the current risk estimate that we're using and this group used was mining data. And the residential data mirrors that or perhaps suggests even a higher risk. And so the central estimate that this body came out with in 1999 was roughly 22,000 lung cancer deaths per year. About 19 of those are from former or current smokers, and about 3,000 are from never smokers. So yes, it's important to stop smoking. The second thing is to reduce your exposure to radon. Here are the risk numbers from EPA based upon the National Academy of Science work. For non-smokers, the risk at EPA's threshold from threshold for action of dying from lung cancer in your home is 7 per 1,000. For smokers, due to radon and the interaction of radon with smoking, is 62 per 1,000. We use currently a number, and EPA uses 21,000, so it's roughly the same. And I show the uncertainty range or confidence interval there, which we always have with science. One of the pooling studies, now this work has been done since the National Academy of Science review, was the North American pooling study. And you see the size there, and let me just interpret that. What was found, the odds ratio of 1.11 means an 11% increase in this case for lung cancer for every 2.7 picocuries per liter increase. 11%. And another piece I'll point out, for periods as short as 5 years, and a common misperception, including in the real estate community, is you have to be exposed to a lifetime. That's absolutely not the case. That's the way we calculate the risk, but your exposures can be much shorter than that. The European risk assessment, which occurred independently, used slightly different methods, which is wonderful, is mirrored those in North America. And what they found was a higher risk, a 16% increase for every 2.7 picocuries per liter increase in the home. And it's estimated in Europe that 15% of the lung cancer deaths are due to radon. That's higher than that used by EPA.
Okay, Joe. I have another question. Looking at these thresholds in the documentation, are they differentiating between adults and children, teenagers, and so on, or is this a reference man?
No, they are not. In part because lung cancer is very rare among young adults and children, and it's primarily something that develops in middle and later years. So there's not a distinction here. The health evidence on whether children are at greater or lesser risk is mixed right now. And so generally from a public health standpoint, we err on the assumption or on the presumption that we need to protect children. That's important. And there's wisdom in that because the more you're exposed to for a longer period of time, the greater the risk. And so we want to stop the child's exposure as young as we can and continue that through the lifetime.
And have they made any connections or about cumulative impact in terms of asthma or anything like that? Is there more incidence, or is it only that we're looking at? Are they only looking at cancer?
The best test evidence is with cancer. There's emerging evidence, although much more controversial and being debated, of leukemia risk. And there's some other areas where there's a suggestion of a risk, but once again, the health evidence is not as clear.
Thank you.
Here, once again, is EPA's threshold for action. In yellow are the figures that you saw earlier. And all I'll point out to here is it's a linear risk. The more you're exposed to, the more the risk is. Basically, you double your exposure, you double your risk. This slide puts in context the number of deaths in the U.S. compared to other things. You see radon on the far left in the red bar. The other home risks here are falls in the purple bar, the third bar from the left. Falls in the home. Over here, the second from the right is in the light or pink shade. Are home fires, and here's carbon monoxide fatalities, accidental carbon monoxide fatalities in the home. And so by comparison, radon stands out. Not that the others are unimportant. They most certainly are very important. And we should be concerned about them, including carbon monoxide. But I just put radon in this perspective so you have a relative sense of what the risk is. And this is my teaser slide. How does the risk compare? But the health evidence, I've already spoken to that. Yes, we should be concerned about mold. The health evidence for radon is far stronger than that we have with mold. For the general population, among subpopulations, asthmatic, people with respiratory, cardiac issues, should be at heightened concern about mold as opposed to the general population. But, I mean, so mold is important, but the health evidence is very strong in radon. Let me talk very briefly about how radon gets indoors where we live, especially times like this. The slide has way too much for you to be able to read. If it's way too much for me and anybody to understand how this complex interaction of all of these factors interplay. But they begin with geology, the rock that we have, and the soil that's created from the rock, and weather conditions, building characteristics. The main one is pressure differences between the indoors and the soil. A lot of people think radon comes in because there's holes in foundations. Forget it. That's relatively unimportant. In general, you cannot seal to keep radon out. Even in new construction, if you go to extreme lengths, you have to control the pressure relationship. Keep that in mind. You'll see how we do mitigation and prevention in just a moment.
Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Angel. I live in the Karst geology, and, you know, our housing landscape is dominated by older homes that were built with limestone that was mined for foundations. And I've often wondered about the radon factor in that regard. And so, and your other slides, too, created a question in my mind. Is there a historical comparison about radon cancer here that we should be thinking about? You know, whether cases of radon caused cancer detected in the 40s and 50s, or, I mean, maybe the science wasn't that sophisticated yet, that we could be comparing that to contemporary data? Because where I lived, every house up until probably the 1920s or 30s had a limestone-laid basement in it. So can you comment on that?
I answer you directly, and then I'll give you a sidebar that I think is important. It comes from Olmsted County Public Health, by the way. The direct answer to your question is, to the best of my knowledge, we first began to measure radon in the occupational, in the mining environment, in the 1950s. The first residential survey that was done in 1954 and 1955 in Sweden. Most radon measurements really began in earnest in the 1980s through the present. So we don't have that historic evidence in terms of over time. When we first proposed the building code adoption, the Builders Association of Minnesota, and I'm personal friends of their chief spokesperson, so I respect her professionally, and I like her as an individual, posed it, and she said, "You have evidence in terms of existing homes, not new homes." And so we went back, and one of the data sets we looked at was Olmsted County Public Health, who's measured, I think, since about 1992, on a free basis, the residents of that county, and I think now an extended area, radon test. So they have the results. They also collect the year the house was built. So we look at that data across the time homes were built. For the most part, there does not appear to be an association between age of construction and indoor radon concentration. There may be, when you look at highly elevated above 20, it appears that those may, although the data is very limited, may be actually increasing proportionally over time. But age of construction and history, we don't know. The karst issue is important because there are certain dynamics that can occur with air movement through karst that challenge some of our traditional thinking. And so I just want to put that on the back burner right now. I'll be happy to talk with you further. But it's one that we're looking at, especially in other regions of the country where we have more karst, the southeast, for example. But we are looking at it, and the Finns and Swedes have looked at the issue as well. This map is the current EPA probability map of radon, and I'll just simply note that Minnesota, roughly the southern half of Minnesota through the metro area, except in Anoka County, and the western third are in zone one high probability. And that's all I'll say, and Mr. Dorschner will discuss this a little bit further. You'll see a Minnesota-specific map. Now, one thing, I put this slide in here. This is from Wausau, Wisconsin, which is a radon hotspot, as we talk about radon hotspots. And I put this up, and with the scaling, there's a lot of green dots that are in here. Those are test results where the green dots occur below EPA's threshold for action. And then at the other end of the scale are stars and triangles that are 20 or more picocuries per liter. And my point here, and I've circled several areas, you see here a home with 4 picocuries, less than 4, next door a home that's over 30 picocuries per liter. This is the reason we have to test every home. It's also the reason we have to test every apartment in ground contact and every school classroom in contact, ground contact, because the radon levels can vary very significantly from one house to house, classroom to classroom, apartment to apartment. Primary reason radon comes in is because our homes are at lower air pressure than the soil, primarily because we heat them. So if you want to fix radon problems in Minnesota homes, you tell our colleagues, forget heating, and you'll have low radon. Well, I'm not going to do that. Neither are you. So how do we fix problems where they occur, and how do we prevent them in new construction? A very simple schematic in homes that are exceed the level that residents desire, we suck on the soil. And in this case, what's illustrated is 4-inch plastic pipe that connects with the subslab area, drain tile if it's present, small fan outside of the habitable area that discharges. And these systems can reduce radon 99%. And virtually this technology allows out of 10,000 elevated homes for us to get 9,990 some. So it's very effective. It's low cost, averaging around $1,200 to $1,500 a year, and the cost of operation is very small. In new construction, this slide illustrates those that are required in the draft Minnesota code. The only difference in concept is what Minnesota building code version is calling for is passive. It means no fan. And the research we have on the effectiveness of this method, if it's done properly, it will achieve typically around a 50% radon reduction. Many builders that I talk to about the new code provision are saying, we're not going to mess around for the extra $200 to cost to put in a fan. We're going to put a fan in because we can have better radon reduction, and we know we're not going to have fallbacks. And so builders are looking beyond this, which I think is quite wise. Let me summarize Minnesota code, building code draft as it currently exists, and the strengths and limitations in my personal opinion. It's short and simple. It's based upon 4 pages of the International Residential Code. It's part of that code which Minnesota adopts by reference. So building officials and builders know it. The limitations are it leaves out some critical details, many of which we've been able to fill in. Of course, there are more details that we need, in my opinion. Those can come over time. And also, I think, in my opinion, and once again, I have to tell you, I am president of a professional association whose members are practicing professionals in the field. So you can see that as a conflict. But I believe very strongly that certified or licensed radon professionals should be doing these installations. And that's not in the code, and I understand reasons for that. So the implications for builders is they actually need to go beyond the Appendix F. That's what we adopted by reference in the Minnesota code. To make passive systems effective and to make them easy to fix if we need to. And that's part of the education I'm part of, and I'm sure Dolly is as well. We need to keep that up. Many builders are going to go with active instead of passive for the reasons I just described. And many builders, because of liability, are looking at using certified people in the state. I think that's very wise. What are some policy considerations, very briefly, that I see? First of all, what's the status of radon policy in this nation and in our state? Today, the sad fact is we have in Minnesota, despite one of the most successful voluntary, if not the most successful voluntary programs in the country and the nation, more homes that are elevated in radon than we've had any time in our history. And the reason for that has been we've added more new homes with elevated radon than we've mitigated or fixed them in 1 year. Your action this last session through the bill that Representative Norton introduced is going to stop that in Minnesota. So we're going to help us turn around that tide and begin to achieve real risk reduction. And some of my perspectives on where we're at, and everything has limitations. My understanding from Dolly, and if we have a Dolly representative here, is I'll let him speak to when it appears the code will go into effect. But to me, my understanding is it's a number of months out. It applies only to single-family dwellings, homes, and townhouses. We need to look at extending that to all low-rise residential buildings, in other words, walk-up apartments, for example. The code allows for, wisely so, active soil depressurization, but it doesn't give the detail the builders need. And it either can be handled through amendments sometime in the future or a very strong educational effort with builders. The code is silent on testing, and there's some reasons for that. It's very important to recommend that people, if they buy a home that's built according to these provisions in Minnesota's building code when it goes into effect, test the home after they occupy it. That's the only way to know if the systems are effective. And finally, I have a note that there's a need to independently, in my opinion, assess the effectiveness of the code to see where we're at with radon reduction. The status of Minnesota's radon program, once again, I want to begin, and I'll say this, and I don't think I can be challenged on this. Minnesota has the strongest voluntary radon program in the country. It does an incredible job, and it's viewed as a leader, but it does not have some tools that would be very helpful. My opinion, we need to seriously consider licensing radon professionals, both in measurement and mitigation. That's the only way that we're going to have some assurance that we have the quality assurance behind the measurement. So they're accurate and reliable. And without that, it's a crapshoot, frankly. I think also that we need to consider seriously as a number of states, and Mr. Hendricks mentioned this, require testing of child care facilities and mitigation that they're elevated. Iowa requires that, and it's gone quite smoothly over the past 5 or so years. that has been on the book. I think we need to look at requiring, unless the department has the funding to provide voluntary testing to school districts, testing in schools and mitigation when elevated and prevention in new construction. Within 5 miles of the capital, we have at least 3 schools that have been mitigated because of elevated radon. There are wonderful case studies of how easy it is to fix the building as they're found to have problems. Let me put in context, though, this risk by far is most serious in the home. So schools, in terms of the setting for the risk, are much less important than homes. Overall, when I look at where we're at nationally, globally, in fact, and in Minnesota, we have failed to achieve radon risk reduction among the disadvantaged population. And that's something personally, as president of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists, is one of my highest priorities. We need to look for ways to bring radon reduction among the limited income and tenants, whether they're limited income or not. And one option to do that is to require radon testing in apartments, in at least ground-contacted units. And finally, I think we need a rural research and demonstration program, perhaps interfacing with low-income weatherization, to see ways that we can improve our radon testing and mitigation in greater Minnesota. Madam Chairman, those are my comments, but I thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Engel? Oh, okay, Representative Shumpert. And then we'll get Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just made the comment that the housing, the radon exposure in housing is much more significant than the schools. Can you explain that?
The evidence that we have for radon in schools indicates nationally it's less frequent to have classrooms above EPA's threshold than in homes. And also we occupy homes for a longer period of time. We occupy our home for a longer period of time than we do the school, unless you're a school employee where you are there for an extended period of time. It would be more equal in that case.
Yes. Mr. McNamara?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One, I was a little bit trying to follow. You mentioned two things. You talked about certified applicators and then regulating, and I actually kind of thought there were, do we have a program in Minnesota, and how does that work? Maybe Dolly is going to address that, and if they are, I guess I can ask them.
It's actually the Department of Health will address that question. What we have, let me just quickly mention, we have two bodies, a professional group that EPA recognizes that certifies. So training requirements, an exam, and continuing that. And those are the National Radon Safety Board and the National Environmental Health Association National Radon Proficiency Program. There's no enforcement that's behind that. So many states, as Mr. Hendry referenced, that do have licensing requirements will require membership in one of those two, because it simplifies things. And in Minnesota, the department will talk about how they interface the program.
Madam Chair, a follow-up to that one, if I could. I'm curious to know your feelings. Do you think we're going to have enough folks doing this work in the near future, or are we going to come up against ourselves and not meet the needs?
Yeah, where the challenge is the greatest is in non-metropolitan areas, because there certified people have to drive with it. So costs go up, so it's a greater issue in terms of availability of skilled professionals in rural areas. That's one of the reasons that a pilot program interfaced with low-income weatherization has attraction to me, because low-income weatherization providers understand some fundamentals here that positions them very well.
And Karen, I have one. This one's a different question. You talked about the pressure relationship, and then you mentioned specifically that Anoka County was out, and I know they tend to have a lot of sand in Anoka County. So if houses are constructed, say they're in the wrong kind of soils, which may be clay or whatever, if a barrier of sand is used alongside and underneath the foundation, what is the effect of radon with that type? I mean, today that seems... I was surprised that you mentioned new construction is a problem. I think we've learned, as Representative Shumpert said, in the older construction, we oftentimes dug the basement with a shovel, so we didn't dig it any absolute bigger than it needed to. But today we tend to oversize. And is that a positive thing, or it doesn't matter?
Well, it's the next thing. The basic point is, when we look at age of the construction and indoor radon concentration, there appears to be, in general, no association. So, new homes, in other words, appear to be equal in terms of their vulnerability having elevated radon as existing homes. Now, there's ways you could finesse that and find some differences, but in general, that's the case. The short answer is we need to deal with it in both new and existing buildings.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up, the question of the sand cushion or layer in between, is that have any effect, or am I...
It can have an effect in as much as it can make it difficult to fix, especially if it's compacted sand, which has been a practice in many areas of Minnesota. Because our soil depressurization systems, when you try to create air pressure differences in tighter materials like compacted sand or clays, it challenges our ability to do that. But virtually always we eventually get that.
Any other questions? I have just a couple quick ones here. I was looking at this list of legislation that was provided to us by MCSL, and I don't know if you've seen it, but it looks like there's a fair amount that is mandated for schools, and then they have retesting. And is that because of the system failure in terms of the pressure gradient, or what is the reason that they would be retesting?
Madam Chairman, the reason is radon concentrations can change. And that, we've learned that over time. Originally, EPA's protocols and those that we've used call for testing one time. And there's evidence that buildings do change with their indoor radon concentration over time. So that's one of the reasons it's important to retest.
Do we know why they change, or what might lead to the difference? Does it have to do with the ventilation? Does it have to do with the other
reasons? If you change ventilation, for example, let's say you put in a commercial grade kitchen exhaust or downdraft like a gen air, and you don't provide makeup air, that increases the pressure difference and will increase radon indoors. So it can be changes that are made, intentionally made, or other changes that occur in the building over time.
Hey, Madam Chair, I might just mention I've received several calls, and one of the issues that came up is that in an existing home, for instance, citizens have been concerned about radon, that there have been times when homes have been purposely ventilated during the nicer times of year. They open the houses, even fans have been put in the windows to draw all the air out, then a test has been quickly done. And so if you retest over time, someone can know whether their home has been perhaps artificially ventilated and isn't giving them a true example of what they're living with on a day-to-day basis. And so I think retesting for some folks when they purchase a home has been suggested. You can ask for the test to be done ahead of time, but you should test it again later. Even with this new construction, I think the radon-resistant new construction, we suggest testing at the time you buy the home, but to have a retest at a later time to make certain that the passive system is working and that you don't need to switch over to an active system.
Madam Chairman, Representative Norton, It's also one of the reasons why, in terms of it's important for licensing of radon measurement professionals, because that, once again, helps set a standard in terms of the way measurements are done. And if buildings were ventilated during testing, that's not an appropriate way to test them. It does occur, and licensure would help reduce that particular issue.
Could you, either of you, talk about the cost of testing? I remember getting a kit a number, maybe 15 years ago from the American Lung Association.
Free at the table.
And what do they cost? What is the cost of, I guess you get the kit, you put it in your home, and these look like they may be an updated version of what I had. And then,
yeah.
And then the cost of the analysis, is that, what does our health department do with that right now?
This is $5, available from a private laboratory, which was successful, I think, on competitive bidding with the department. That includes lab analysis for $5. That's for a short-term test kit. A longer-term test kit is in the range of $25 to $30.
And I might mention there were some surge grants that the Department of Health has given out. Olmsted County has those, and you can get the longer-term little container for free. And you get the test, you put it in your home, you mail it in, and they mail you back the results, and it's entirely free. So I think some of the state money has been used for grants to some counties to have it done free of charge as well.
And the longer term is a couple of months. I can't remember what.
Generally, it's 3 months to a full year.
3 months to a full year. Okay. And a shorter term is?
2 to 7 days, yeah. Commonly.
Okay. Representative Shumper.
Well, what about radon in water supplies? I'm 99% certain that our community, La Crescent, for example, is doing some major changes in its water supply because of its high constant radon levels. Given that we drink water, wouldn't that be a much more likely way to get cancer than from your indoor air?
Angel?
Representative, not at all. In fact, Congress, through the State Water Drinking Act, required EPA, which they haven't completed, to set a level for radon in water. And when the water people in EPA, the risk assessors, looked at it and compared it with other contaminants we regulate in water, it would set a requirement that would save 100 and some odd lives a year from the ingestion. The inhalation it's 100 some from all risk with radon. The ingestion is maybe low double digits of that. Most of the risk with radon in water is from air eating it, like showering, bathing, washing dishes when it's released into the air. The risk is much greater.
And there are concerns for some well owners, and you can have your water tested. I live on a well, and I'm going to have my well tested when I learn some of this. So you can do testing for it and make some determinations after you have your level.
And I would presume that the type of cancer or whatever other illness may come from ingesting is different than when it's breathed in. What is the site of a radon-responsive cancer?
It's death.
A radon-responsive cancer.
It's gastrointestinal cancer. And so and the certainty of that is much greater. Uncertainty is much greater than that with air. So.
Is anybody testing? Has that been tested?
Pardon?
Has that been tested? You're saying it's been much more uncertain. Has it been evaluated?
It has. That's what EPA has done through the risk assessment process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's consistent with the global evidence, so it's not just EPA.
And that's on adults?
Pardon?
And that's just on adults?
That's what I do not know. That's my answer.
I do have one other question. I thought the evidence of the increase, the difference between men and women's deaths due to cancer was an interesting number up there, and I noticed you had, there were also the numbers related to medical exposure and other kinds of exposure. I'm just thinking, has anybody looked at the issues of, mammograms and the other kinds of exposures that women have in this whole regard in relationship to radar and exposures? Is you know, are we accumulating, you know, exposures here that are related to radar in any way?
You're out of my area of expertise, and I'll defer to the Manitoba Department of Health.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Nice to know we have a hometown person available.
We do. And our last presenter, Madam Chair, is Dale Dorsner from the Department of Health. And I know there's some other folks from there, as well as representation now from the Department of Labor and Industry. So if questions come up, you can direct those. But Dale is the Indoor Air Unit Supervisor of the Environmental Health Division of the Minnesota Department of Health. We are really fortunate in this state to have the Department of Health with a long history of focus on radon. And so we have an excellent department, and the department was recently recognized by the U.S. EPA for the work that they do. So I think they'll share with you what's in the works right now, and do get your tips before you leave. I keep a couple, I was telling them earlier, in my office and hand them out when people come for interviews, ask if they've tested their home and give them one. So grab a handful before you leave today for your constituents.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Norton, and thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity for us to discuss what we do here at in Minnesota under our Minnesota Department of Health radon program. I have some handouts of kind of a little factoid handout of different activities that are currently going on in the radon program. I'm not going to talk too much about the health effects because Mr. Angel, I think, did a very well job on a very good job on that. And I'm just going to concentrate on the programmatic activities that we have, given the limited resources that we have. So, and I'll talk more about that. I also want to give recognition to the legislature and Representative Norton for the RNC. Significant impact to public health. Last year, the legislature passed the Freedom to Breathe Act to help people from secondhand smoke and then the RNC. So in last year, the legislature took care of number one and number two risks for lung cancer. So you all should be commended for that. Just defining radon in Minnesota, and this is a breakdown of what was presented earlier on the national map, but this is Minnesota. If you can see here that 68 of our counties are located in Zone 1, 19 in Zone 2. Zone 1 is the highest probability that radon will be at the EPA action level or higher of 4 picocuries per liter of air. Also should be noted that within Zone 1, 80% of the population in Minnesota resides in those counties. So part of the reason why we get some grant funding from the US EPA is because of our risk here in Minnesota. Just briefly, Minnesota radon program is housed within the Minnesota Department of Health Environmental Health Division. It's in the indoor air unit, which I supervise. It's an unregulated radon. We're an unregulated radon state, which means that we don't license. We don't have a lot of authority to govern the industry. So we really rely on US EPA funding, federal funding that we get. We're quite lucky in that we get probably one of the top grant amounts. And part of that is because of our risk, and I would like to say the other part, I think, is that when there's extra money available at the US EPA, they try to get it to Minnesota because they know we're going to spend it wisely. And I want to go through some of the things that we do on a voluntary basis, trying to get some of the outcomes that EPA is looking for. Much of our money that we get, we pass through a sub, what we call a sub-award or grant, and they go to local public health. But there's a catch on that, in that for the surge grant funding, we need to match a state dollar for every dollar received at the federal level. So that's another barrier for our program internally, is that for every dollar we accept, we need to find a general fund dollar to match that. And we found creative ways legally to do that, but it's a challenge for us. We also ask that smaller local public health agencies collaborate to cover underserved areas. We ask them to partner together and come in as partners in grants to cover multi-counties, and we've been pretty successful at that.
Excuse me, Representative Schumer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell us right at this point what your total radon program budget is, just so we can have a sense of...
Yeah. Currently, Madam Chair and committee member, currently our budget, we were allocated a hard number of $362,000, I want to say.
Okay.
And usually that gets bumped up as EPA, US EPA money gets passed back to them. They usually, it gets funneled back to us, some of it. So typically, in the last 3 years, I can say we've ranged from anywhere from $450,000 to $600,000. And a lot of that matching funds comes from our water program. They test for radionuclides, and so we can take money from that. And the other major portion, probably even more than the water program, is from the monies that we pass through on the local level. We ask the locals as well to do a one-to-one match, so we're using our local partnerships to use that funding match at a state level.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a couple of questions that probably works real close to be a follow-up to Representative Schumper. The radon kits, then, are they part of that budget number that you mentioned?
That's right.
Okay, thank you. And then... how are you distributing them, and how are they available? Is there a way for our constituents to find out? Now that you mentioned your budget, I can realize my next question was how many of them are available, and with the numbers you've just mentioned, we can't send them to every home and with mailing, or how does the distribution work, and what are the possibilities for our constituents?
Madam Chair and committee member, basically, how we, at the state level, we put it up on our website of where to go to get it. Mr. Angel mentioned that it's $5 a test kit. They can go right to the lab and download and have it mailed to them and ship back to the lab for analysis. That's how we do it internally. We also purchase a couple hundred for events like this and when other Minnesota residents test high the first time, we have a policy where we'll give them a free test kit to re-verify that short-term test. So the locals, when they come in for grants, and I'll talk a little bit about how we give out money to the local public health agencies, but they have the option to issue them free, or some of them actually establish a slight monetary value to them to keep them their program going so that they can replenish the radon test kit. But we find that it's better done at a local level than at the state, but on the same token, we have it on our website.
Madam Chair, just to solidify, thank you. They need to pay you $5 to get the test. They send that in. Is that true?
Madam Chair, no, that's not it. They go right to the lab and pay them. We don't take in any money at all.
Okay. Can you send us, through the chair or whatever, how an electronic link where we could let our constituents know what they would need to do? So if I understand it right, for $5 they can get this test done, and you could probably let us know how we can send them in a direction to get that done?
Do that. Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
Thank you.
And then, since we're talking about this, the next step is, of course, they get the test results back and there's an alert and they need to do some mitigation. What kind of public support for the mitigation do we have? Is it related to your department? Is it through our housing department, housing finance agency? What kind of
I think I'll cover that in my presentation,
okay.
But a brief answer to that is we have a 1-800 number. We always have somebody on the phone to answer questions about radon, so we can play what I call armchair quarterback technically to help them out. And we have a list of mitigators that they can go to. And the rest of that, I think I'll cover how else we help them.
Okay, I'll just wait for the answer. I'm curious, again, with the issue of homeowners versus renters and low-income households and so on. So if you come into that, I'll just wait.
Okay. I just want to briefly mention that we do multi-county community health boards, surge sub-grantees, colleges and universities for research, non-profit organizations such as the American Lung Association. That's kind of where our money goes. I'll have a picture of kind of how it's distributed across the state. Our radon program priorities are to establish measurable outcomes and priorities to increase the number of homes tested and mitigated and homes built radon resistant. And these mirror what US EPA has for their priorities as well. We support research and activities that influence public policy for radon risk reduction. An example of this is we funded some funding to see what active subslab depressurization radon systems have on controlling moisture in basements. And the University of Minnesota Cold Climate Housing Program is working on that. We established effective partnerships that share the same goals in reducing risk of radon. So builders are one of them that we try to partner with. Implement innovative radon awareness activities, and I'll have at the end of my presentation some of the things that we've done recently. The last 4 or 5 years, our priority in the radon program has been radon-resistant new construction, RNC. And there's some challenges with that, but the work that the legislature did last year has given us a great jump start. So I put a check mark next to there. But we've also worked with recruiting builders to use RNC practices. We support research, as I mentioned, market and promote the benefits of RNC. And that's something that we're currently working on is trying to establish a marketing benefit for people to install radon-resistant new construction systems. Because being a voluntary state, not anymore, but we really need to do the social marketing to reduce risk in Minnesota. Here's kind of the award used to support local public health. We had 27 grantees this year. We try to fund everyone that comes in. That doesn't necessarily happen. We went from a non-competitive process to more of a competitive process for accountability reasons. And here kind of gives you a breakdown of 331,000 that we get from US EPA. 180,000 of that will go through to our grantees. And I should mention the radon program has two FTEs basically runs the entire state radon program. Two technical FTEs, I should say, and one support FTE. We have no funding for mitigation, and the reason why we don't have that is because the federal mandate for the surge dollars does not allow for it. That you can use it for public outreach, and testing is considered public outreach. As soon as we get into mitigation, we are very limited on what we can do. We have done some very innovative things. We've used demonstration projects where we've actually done mitigation. I'll talk about some of those activities. So we establish three priority areas annually. I talked a bit about those. Then we publish a request for proposal to local public health departments, nonprofit organizations, and universities. Basically, in the RFP, it's a request to help assist us in addressing our priority areas. So we identify what our priority areas are. We ask them to submit a proposal on how they can help us meet that. The grantees need to demonstrate how they plan to meet these goals and have a work plan or process to measure their outcomes. and we find that very important.
Excuse me, just a quick question. When you're saying priority areas, are you talking about program areas or geographical areas?
Madam Chair, that would be program or program priority.
Program priority.
For RETA.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right.
Here's a map that shows basically in the blue have no radon programs. This is based off of a report we get from public health that they have to check on whether or not they're addressing radon programs. And the ones in blue don't have a radon program. The ones in white have some level of a radon program. And the yellow are grant recipients. One of the new things we're doing this year, and I have to give credit where credit is due, we hired a new staff person that has very, very good sense in public outreach, and she has a medical background. So we're really utilizing her expertise here. But we're following the Regional Radon Advisory Leadership Council. She's developing this to basically try to get those underserved areas and establish key partners or champions within the regions to get the local public health on board and to mentor them, if you will.
Oh, Representative Shumpert?
Yes. Can you tell us, you just said a minute ago, you identified three program areas each year to focus your work on. What are the current three program areas? Could you tell us just briefly?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Council, or Committee Member, basically they're radon-resistant new construction, testing homes and getting homes with high level of radon mitigated. Those are our three priority areas.
Excuse me, just to follow up on that, you said mitigation? Is for the high level homes, is that what you said?
Mitigate homes with high levels of radon.
Even though you have no dollars to do that, you find a way to make that your third priority, is what you're saying?
That's the creative art.
Okay, that's what we'd like to hear some more about that, I think. Thank you.
This map was taken from our another division, actually, with state consulting nurses. This is the regions that we're going to use for our advisory council, and try to find champions in each one of these regions to spread the awareness of radon. This is a brand new concept for us. And I won't do it much justice, but just to know that we're going to try to regionalize and find champions within each region of the state to make sure we got coverage across, moving our 80% coverage or 90% coverage to 100%. The purpose of the Minnesota Radon Medical Advisory Network, this is another new program that the same staff person is working on. It's to bring the medical community in and find out how best to address lung cancer prevention due to radon and how does it fit into a medical model and practice. We think that our hypothesis is that if an oncologist brings up the issue, it's going to be more accountable, perhaps, than a public health official coming in. So it's a great educational opportunity to do that. Also, give input to our radon state program of what different areas we could work on and provide feedback on different resources. There might be, health plans out there that could provide money or whatever, but we want to explore that idea. As you can tell, with very limited resources, we're trying to figure out where we can get money and who we can tap into to further our cause to help protect and maintain Minnesota. This is the list of the current participants on that medical advisory. I think it's just just worthy to note that we have pulmonologists on there, we have oncologists on there, and they're from different hospitals and medical facilities. And I think that this will grow, but I think these are the key members, and we'll have other members join as become available, hopefully across the state. The other thing that we're working on is trying to partner with our tobacco prevention and control section, because we're both looking to reduce lung cancers and see if there's a method or an opportunity to collaborate to get the same message out that the risk from lung cancer. So we'll be working on that and look for shared goals in preventing lung cancer. The question that you brought up earlier as far as how do you get that done, being a non-regulatory state, being a voluntary state, we thought we needed a way to entice mitigators to work with us. And one way was to list them on our website as possible mitigators. This has a double bonus, one for the constituents of Minnesota, they know where to go get a mitigator, and two, the mitigators get some kind of marketing benefit from it as well. But to get on our list, we have a criteria, and one is to take a certified radon training course, Midwest University Radon Consortium, that is directed by Ms. Bill Angel, the University of Minnesota. Is the one that we use most typically around here. They have to take the national test, and they have to belong to either the National Environmental Health Association or the National Radon Safety Board. And the reason for that is we don't have any way to what do I want to say? We don't have a heavy stick if they're a bad actor. The NEHA and NSRB have a code of ethics where if they get enough complaints alleged against them, they can get decertified or delisted or be not recognized as a member. And as soon as that happens, they come off our list. That's kind of our innovative way of making sure that we don't have a significant bad actor out there. And then they need to submit quarterly reports to MDH. And these reports are basically how many mitigations have you done in the state of Minnesota and a zip code? So we kind of have an idea what is being done out there. And that's just for us, number one, to report outcomes back to US EPA as part of getting the federal funds. And two, look for underserved areas. And then that hopefully will help us prioritize where the money goes in subsequent years.
I do have a question. You brought about the term underserved areas. Have you identified disparities in terms of race and income, in terms of the testing, in terms of the occurrence of radon? Is anybody looking at that at all?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. And what I can say is no. That's the most blunt answer. And it has to do with the funding issue. We don't have... we have very limited resources, and we're trying to get the risk down. What I can say is that there is a disparity that we hear about anecdotally with low-income residents that test their home. They can afford to test because it's fairly cheap, but once they get to that point of they need to mitigate, they don't have the resources then to mitigate. And we're currently working... and trying to figure out a solution for that. One, you may be working with the housing folks, the low-income housing folks, and seeing if we can kind of tie it into a healthy homes campaign. With that said, we have no money. We can do a couple demonstration projects, but the federal dollars that we get from EPA strictly prohibit us from mitigating homes.
Has the department ever asked for this kind of funding?
The department hasn't asked for this that I'm aware of, and I think we're, we're on a continuum here. I mean, first we have to get the outreach out there, and I think we're doing a good job of that and taking the low-hanging fruit with the amount of money that we have. But I'm not aware of the department asking for that.
Mm-hmm. And the department does have an active health disparities unit, and actually we gave them unrestricted money in this last session, I think probably for another full position. Or at least maybe a partial position. I guess it was only about 50,000. Anyway, I'm just wondering if are you at all coordinating with them with this program, and has there been any communication back and forth with the health disparities portion of the health department?
To be frank, there hasn't been, and it's probably the ignorance on my part. But knowing that, I'll certainly go knock on their door. I look for money anywhere I can get it, so I will go tap on their shoulder.
Yeah, and I wasn't even thinking so much of funding, because they don't have funding for mitigation. If I understand, it's cost about, at least I heard somewhere a figure of $1,200, which surprised me. I thought it would be more than that, actually. But if it is that low, it would seem like there'd be a couple barriers to low-income people. If they're not a homeowner, they're a renter, and they find out they've got rain on, they don't exactly have the right to go mitigate that property. They're going to need to get cooperation from their property owner. And I can tell you, representing a majority of renters in my district, that's not always easy to come by, even if there are health problems that are documented. But the other thing is, I think just tracking this, if there were some way for you to know that who the underserved people are they the same people that have the other issues with health disparities? And I would guess some of this is a GIS issue, putting it on a map, and others might just be adding some tracking to your data that includes income, race, gender. We know that women apparently have more lung cancer. I'd like to know if there are more women living in homes that are, have radon with single parents or whatever. It just seems to me like the work that they do in the health studies department might lend, if not actual funding, to some documentation. Since you seem willing to do that, I just want to encourage you to think about that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, good points. And I think we struggle with where do we get our biggest bang for the buck. We know that basically most homes in Minnesota have high radon. So I don't know, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, which is dangerous. If a lot of resources should be paid towards that, or should we be trying to concentrate on getting all homes mitigated and then trying to figure out a way to help those that can't afford it? I understand there's a huge issue with disparities there, and we need to somehow address that, and I'll look into that.
Thank you.
Going back to our mitigator lifting program, basically the results that we're seeing are that the mitigator contractor gets business from us. They can use MDH brand recognition. Basically having their name on our website, they can say we're listed on MDH website. And probably the thing that helps them out most is if they come into a problem, we actually have a staff person with building science expertise that can go out there and help them diagnose the issue so that the mitigator doesn't walk away from a problem house. And being a non-regulatory state, we find this very important to the success of our program, because as you can imagine, if we have a couple of bad stories, it's gonna hurt the industry and hurt the cause of promoting radon resistance construction or mitigation. So we find that very important, and that's part of our funding, general fund money that we get from EPA for technical capacity. Our results are that we get to keep in contact with the mitigators. We get some recognition from them. Opportunity to educate consumers, because they call us and we can say, go to the list and here's what you should look for in a mitigator, and you should expect your levels to be below 2. So it gives us an opportunity to talk to them. And we can, with some assurances, make sure that the homes are mitigated properly and to maximize the risk reduction. mitigate our education opportunities. I mentioned this, we utilize Midwest University Radon Consortium, and here's some trainings that are going to happen for CEUs, radon-resistant new construction, advanced diagnostics. Basically, how do you determine whether your system that you're going to install is going to work properly? Those are what I mean by doing diagnostics. And we try to get those around the regions of the state so all the mitigators have a fair opportunity to do that. On the builder side, on new construction side, we're establishing a new or piloting a project to capitalize on the new radon-resistant new construction legislation, in which the builders will be listed much like the mitigators list. They can be listed on the MDH website, but they have to follow our gold standard practices. So some of the things that aren't in the legislation, they're going to have to follow through with. One of them, and probably the most significant, is they have to use an active subslab depressurization system. So basically, they have to put the fan on the RNC mandated system. But then there's also some details that we think are important. One is testing, one is labeling the pipe, the other is making sure cracks are sealed and sealing the cold joint to make sure the success of that. We don't have that program up and running yet, but we assume that that will be running within the next year. Some of the results that we're looking at from that is we anticipate that contractors will want to do this because they're going to get business from being on our site. We anecdotally know this because we get calls asking, do you know a builder that can build me a radon-resistant home? So that will do that. They can use, again, MDA brand recognition, and hopefully for them they can differentiate themselves from those that are just following the standard building code and give them a competitive edge. And then again, they can use our MDH technical resources. Basically, if they have a footprint or a model that they're going to build a lot of homes like, we've done this with other builders. We go out there and we do diagnostics on it and with some certainty say if you follow these same building practices, your likelihood of having very low radon are good. So use this model and you'll be good. The results for us, again, we're going to have a great opportunity to keep in contact with the contractors, an opportunity to educate consumers again, and we're going to get substantial increased risk and reduction throughout the state of Minnesota. An example of what fun this is, basically the College City Homes, we partnered with them, and we did the technical support with them. They're currently building all their new homes with RNC with active subslab depressurization systems on. They do 150 to 200 new homes each year, and their reason for doing it was it's for the greater good. And when meeting with them, they would see themselves as like the Mercedes-Benz in cars. The first safety features are going to start with them, so that's how they're actually using it as a marketing tool. Long-term test kits are left in the home all their new homes at the time of their initiation walkthrough, and then they're retrieved at their 1 year. Warranty period when they come back, and then they send in the test kits on behalf of the homeowner. If it's a high level, they'll go back and mitigate. They've been doing this for 3 years now, and I haven't heard that they've had one high level of radon. So, good success story there. We recognize that builder at a stakeholders meeting at MDH. Talk about a little bit about the children. It was brought up several times. When we get when we get additional money from US EPA, we find special projects, and One of the ones that we did last year is that we offered free testing to 13,000 family child care facilities. And of that, we distributed over 1,200 that signed up for the testing. We gave those test kits out. 30 facilities have been mitigated with MDH purchased materials and donated contractor labor. This is one of those unique ways how we get around using federal dollars to mitigate. We actually can buy materials for demonstration projects, and we consider this a demonstration project. Most of the mitigated will be done by the end of the summer of 08.
Let us ask you a question. That number $1,200, I think, was presented earlier as a potential or average cost. Seems awfully low for what you said. If I understand, I just from the one graphic, you're going around the house and you're getting under the, or you're somehow helping, as they said, suck the air through. The cost is the excavation, and somehow penetrating the building, and I don't really get it. I'd like to see more of a graphic description. And I guess my final question though is that $1,200, is that your experience? That's your number in Minnesota that the mitigation cost is?
Yes. Do you want to comment on that? Or?
Madam Chair, I think there's two things here. There's one, mitigation in new homes, and sometimes the comparison is used, it costs several hundred to build it at the time the home is built, and then mitigation costs more later. So that's part of what we talk about. But they don't necessarily put in the mitigation system that you would for radon-resistant new construction in the home. There are different techniques, and depending on how your home is built, the estimate I have for my home is considerably higher because I have a unique ventilation system with no air exchange at all in my basement, so that needs to be built in. And so different homes have different, I think we talked 1,200, I've heard as high as close to 4,000 for some homes. So I think there's a range, but it's cheaper at the time of construction. But that's a different procedure, is what the point I want to make.
Chair, I'm sorry I didn't answer that before. And the 1,200 is at the low end for mitigators to go in. And when I'm talking mitigators, it's the older houses that were already built that they have to now fix. Simply put, what all they need to do, very simply put, is to drill a 4-inch hole through the slab and route the pipe up and out the roof and put an inline fan in. Now, we hope that they do diagnostics to make sure they understand that where they put that pipe is going to work to get the full footprint, but there's not a lot of excavation for mitigation of existing homes. We're just creating a pressure differential from underneath the slab so no gas or other contaminants can come through that slab.
Well, here's the question I have. I thought 4 or 5 years ago I got a new furnace, and because of our city ordinance, they had to put a ventilating tube into my basement. Big. Lots of cold air comes in through there. am I taking care of the radon in my house, if I actually have it by that? Are we working together with these people who do? But my question is, on the one that I did a number of years ago, you're not supposed to put it where there's any breeze. It's supposed to be where there's no movement of air in the basement. So, there's always movement of air. So are we, are we getting reliable tests? Are we working with the folks who do the furnaces and the local governments who require these different kinds of aspects of ventilation? I guess I'm just trying to figure out what we're really knowing and maybe not knowing because of the connection between the requirements. Yeah, building.
Madam Chair, those are very good questions, and those are issues that we struggle with being a voluntary state. We get whatever we're given, and we're asked for. So we're, what we do is ask for test results and how they're done and where they're put. They're not being done by people that probably analyze those issues of air movement and where that most exposure is going to be. they're being done by the homeowner that's reading the instructions. Now, this is a double-edged sword, right? It's $5. It's easy to test. Everybody should be able to test their home. But, you know, the more sophisticated you want to get with making sure that the levels we're getting, you know, the higher the it's going to cost for people to test their home. So I understand the question, and it's a good one. I don't have all the answers for you.
Thank you. Okay, I know we're getting closer to...
I'm almost done.
Madam Chair, if I can just really quick. The way I understood the presentation, the importance for the radon is drilling the hole through the floor and relieving that pressure from under the building. The makeup air for your new furnace, which many of us that lived in older homes had to change over to, is getting the air from outside into the furnace area. That is different than the issue of relieving this pressure. There was a drawing that he showed earlier that included some pipe underneath it. I think that's a design they're using in the new construction to facilitate better movement underneath your basement, but I would imagine it's not normally something they do in the older construction. They're trying to relieve this pressure from underneath to get it up, and it looked like it went all the way out above the home, right through your roof and everything, and that's basically what they do for $1,200. Well, or I'm sure it can vary. As Representative Norton said, it depends on your makeup air, I would imagine, and all kinds of stuff on whether you where your home and some of those challenges. So I would be reluctant to use the 12. That might be ideal scenario situation for an easy home, depending on number of level and things like that. I think that's your important thing is the $5 test. That may just lead to the bigger issue, whether it's a renter, homeowner, or what. Now we got an issue that is $1,250, $4,000, whatever it is.
I guess, thank you. And I guess what I'm wondering is, though I remember reading instructions, you don't do where there's any movement of air. So, which is hard if you have a kind of furnace situation that there's movement all the time, and especially in older homes. So I'm just trying to understand what we are really asking ourselves to do, and you know, how accurate it is, and maybe this can be a discussion later, but your explanation was helpful, but I still don't think I know the answer to getting the clarity around a space that has air moving through it when you're trying to test for radon.
Madam Chair, I'll just try to allude to that. Basically, I think what they're suggesting is that they don't want you to put a fan in your house when you're testing this, or put it in a precarious spot that you're not actually being exposed to, so next to the furnace. Certainly if you put it down in your you know, family room and you know the air is moving across it, it's not a problem. It's just that they don't want it in a very unique spot that you'll have a lot of air movement.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up, I made the comment to our committee legislative assistant, Mr. Johnson, that my first reaction when Representative Norton, I was a little slow, but then I figured it out. What she was alluding to is, I don't know that it's necessarily the home, inspector or whatever you're called that comes in, but you have the potential for a homeowner that has their home for sale to have conveniently opened their windows on Monday when it was 40 above and ventilated it out, and the inspector comes on Tuesday. And I don't think there's a question, did you ventilate your house yesterday? And all of a sudden, the kit may show something different on Tuesday when after the new homeowner comes in, they may want to have the kit for a month later to reevaluate. As sad as it is, I think that may be one of the scenarios of Representative Norton. And I was a little slow to catch it, and then a light bulb went off.
You're very seldom slow, but what I was... it does bring back this issue again of air movement. So I guess it's probably an imperfect science at this point. I'm kind of interested to see, though, how careful we can diagnose an issue when you have movement of air. So at least it slowed me down. I didn't test it because there was no way not to have the air moving.
Yeah, quick question. Are schools mandated to do a test every year? Are schools mandated to do any tests? Like,
Madam Chair, committee member. Right now, I don't believe that Department of Education is mandating radon tests. What I do know is that they allow it under their health and safety funding levy criteria for testing for radon, and it's actually one of their numbered priorities, what number it is, I don't know, but I know it's in there, that they can use their health and safety funding for it. Let me also say that one of the largest school districts that we're actually in their district right now has tested all their schools, and there are, and we've, with extra money from EPA, have volunteered thousands of test kits for schools to do this. So there are several districts out there that did this. I know several years back, 10 or so, that there was a big push for radon testing, and they did that. When we pushed to get the results for those, they're hard to come by. So, you know, we work with schools also within the program for with our tools for schools, indoor air quality, and that's one of the priorities. So, are they mandated to test? No. Are they encouraged to test? I think the answer is yes.
Thank you. Do you have more to present, or are you about?
I'm almost done. This is just some of the outreach activities that we do, the home and garden shows. This was an interesting one. We actually put an active RNC stimulated system in the Eco House. This gave great publicity. 350,000 people walked through there. So we averaged that out, 3,000 people an hour potentially saw the RNC information. We worked with Kevin O'Connor on this at this old house. They actually used a Minneapolis house to mitigate. And this is just an example of diagnostic testing that we offer to help the contractors out. I brought test kits. We come bearing gifts and magnets, and feel free to have those.
Thank you very much. President Norton, I know you were able to get the Department of Labor and Industry to come over. Do you want them to just make a few comments, and then we'll wrap it up?
Sure, yes.
Thank you.
John Ruskowski from the Department of Labor and Industry is here, and if you have a question, maybe we could just ask him, Madam Chair, if he could give us an update on where we stand, and I think the question was, when can we expect them to be in published code?
Right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman Clark. Nice to be in front of your committee. Nice to see you all again. This bill, we cooperated with the author last spring when she introduced it and made some changes because at the time, and still going on, the department is engaged in updating the energy code. And so that's when she took our advice and said that with all new home construction, radon detection underneath the sub-slab would be part of the new construction of all residential housing. The energy code, I thought, was going to be done by the end of 2007, but because, as you can imagine, there are many stakeholders involved with the new energy code. I was just informed this week that the adoption looks to be closer to September of this year. So that's my update. I think everything else has kind of been covered. But
all right.
Do you have any questions?
Any questions from any members or from the
division?
If we were to, I guess I have a question. If we were to decide that we wanted to have be a regulatory state in terms of the inspectors, what does that do to the rules? Process of that. I'm not saying that Representative Norton is proposing that, but I think there were certainly some issues that were raised that we might want to consider that, or somebody might want to consider that. Would you still be able to get us the rules so far?
I think the energy code process would continue and would be completed by the fall. And I think if you're contemplating regulation, whether you're talking about licensing for testing or installation, that would begin a new rule process after the bill would be passed.
Okay.
And as you know, our rules are, it would probably take a couple of years.
I am receiving calls from builders who are ready for this, and I guess I'm a little disappointed it's taking as long. Is there anything we can do to move it along, or is it, because as I understood it, it was near final draft and being ready to publish for the intent to adopt, and I thought it was just 30 days after that. And is there something that's happened that we need to know about or we could help with? Or?
Representative Norton and Madam Chair, my understanding from a brief conversation I had with the Assistant Commissioner is that the delay has nothing to do with this particular issue. It just has to do with other issues contained in the Energy Code, that there has been a strong inclination by representatives, I believe, from the builders and representatives of cities to go above and beyond the Energy Code, and the department is saying we already are above and beyond, if you will, on new home construction as far as how much homes provide for energy dependency. So if at some point you would like the members of the executive committee who are working on the Energy Code to come before your committee, that might be something I would recommend.
This
was news to me just yesterday that there was going to be this 6 months, 9 months delay.
Okay.
Because I've been told all during, since the bill passed last spring, that the estimation would be it would have been done by now.
Thank you. And it really can't proceed independently. It has to be part of the whole code, it sounds like, huh?
That was our recommendation, correct. Because the builders are going to need to know what it is there, what the new code is.
Yeah. Pretty straightforward.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Can I just summarize saying thank you very much for hearing this. It's an important issue that was brought to me by a constituent, and I carried it forward. And might I just say, I don't need to continue to carry all the radon legislation. It would be wonderful if some of you on the Housing Committee would embrace this as I have for my constituents. And one of the suggestions or one of the issues that I heard not addressed but raised by the Department of Health has to do with the cost for some families, and Representative Clark, you raised that as well, for low-income families, that perhaps in the future we could look at buffering up the department with some mitigation grants for certain qualifying individuals as a possibility for future legislation. So, again, I want to thank you for the support you gave me, and for I think we did a great thing, but there's more to be done, and thank you for the hearing time today.
Thank you very much. The committee is adjourned.